Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 5, Vidura's Talks with Maitreya, Text Number 12. Muni, Vivakshu, Bhagavat. This is called Sandhi. Sandhi means when words combine with each other, they change their sounds. So the actual words are Muni, Vivakshu, and here it's Bhagavat. Gunanam, Saka, Api, Te, Bharatam, Aha, Krishna, Yasmin, Narinam, Gramya, Sukha, Anuvadai, Mati, Grihita, Nu, Hare, Katayam, Munir Vivakshu Bhagavat Gunanam, Sakapite Bharatam Aha Krishna, Yasmin Rinam Gramya Sukhanuvader Matira Grihita Nuhare Katayam. Muni, the sage. Vivakshu, Shu, described. So the advantage of putting it, this is in what's called the nominative case. There are 8 cases in Sanskrit. And the first case that usually the words are translated into, or the diacritics are, not the diacritics, the transliteration, is put into the nominative case. The reason for that, nominative means the, because nominative would be the third person, singular or plural or dual. The reason it's put into that, because if you see the word in a different case, for instance, there's nominative, then there's the objective case, there's the instrumental, the dative case, and other cases too. When you see the same word in the different cases, then you might be able to recognize it, because it changes quite a bit. But if you think that the word is munir, and then you see it in some other case, you may not recognize it so easily. So usually, just to give us some idea what the word is, it's always put into the nominative case. Therefore, when we see munir, then we understand that it's the, actually this is what's called Sandhi. It is in the nominative case, but due to the fact that it's next to a V, then the IH turns into an R. Just like the UH in the next word turns into an R because it's next to a V. Just for the sound of it. It's called voice and unvoiced consonants in Sanskrit. So, we're going through this every day. We're reading these verses. So it's not just some ritual that we go through. And maybe just for most of us, maybe just a ritual that we go through. But it's not supposed to be a ritual. We're actually supposed to be learning something. And it's not really painful. It may seem painful, but this is, my God, they're trying to teach me Sanskrit. This is some dead language. 5,000-year-old dead language, and they keep on going over this every day. I'm so tolerant, I sit there and smile, but I don't take it seriously. Although it's agitating my brain like anything, but still I'm tolerant. No, it's actually not so painful. It's actually nice language. We're not doing it to inflict pain upon the devotees. It's being done so we can actually assimilate the philosophy more easily. The idea is that assimilation means we take something from what's described in one particular way, and then the same thing is described in a slightly different way in a different part, and then we look at it from both angles and we get a better idea of what it's all about. That's like if you want to figure out what an elephant is, If you look at only one part of it, you may not get a good idea. That one group of sages, or a group of sages, they wanted to figure out what an elephant was, but they were all blind. So one of them examined the trunk, he thought the elephant was a trunk. Another examined the leg, he thought the elephant was a leg. Another one examined the tail, he thought an elephant was a tail. But because they were only examining one part of the elephant, they couldn't really understand what the elephant actually is. The reason why the same philosophy actually is explained in many different ways is that so we can see it in many different viewpoints and therefore understand it more thoroughly. That's called assimilating the philosophy. If we want to make advancement in Krishna consciousness, then we have to assimilate the philosophy to see it from many different perspectives. And the Sanskrit, we're reading it because it just serves as, for one thing, it's a key to help us understand where to assimilate the philosophy. Just like this word munir, so in Bhagavad Gita, those who learn these things, and you know, it says, yoga yukta munir brahma nature nadigachati. So there are many different words, and places, for instance, in just the Bhagavad Gita alone, where the word muni is used. And if we hear that, for instance, Dukeshu Vamanagmanaksukeshu Vigata Spriha Vitaraga Vayakrota Stitidir Munir Uchite. So there Prabhupada defines Muni as one who can agitate his mind in many different ways by mental speculation. So we can see how the word Muni is used in many different places if we learn these things, and then see, you know, how Muni is being used here and what's the subtle differences, if there are any. Similarly with all the other words, because we may not become great Sanskrit scholars, but there are certain words that are being repeated every day. Every day we go over it. For instance, a word like te. What does te mean? How many devotees know what te means? So we've heard probably te at least maybe 2,000-3,000 times. Or say we've been hearing Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam in Bhagavad Gita class, maybe say 200 times a year. And say we've been in the movement for 5 years, so that's 1,000 times. And maybe at least 50% of the time te is used. So we've heard it maybe 500 to 1,000 times and repeated it with the word for word meaning. So if we don't know what it means, our batting average is not very good in learning. And why is it not good? It's because we just don't take it very seriously. We think, oh, what a waste of time. Another 15 minutes wasting my time going through this ritual of learning Sanskrit that maybe one or two, you know, scholars in our temple, you know, who have time to go over these things, who drill it into them 24 hours a day just to show everyone how bright they are. But I'm a humble, you know, devotee. I'm not so puffed up. I'm not trying to impress people with my Sanskrit. So I'm not going to learn it. I'm going to show it, you know, humble fool I am. That I don't need these things, Sanskrit. I have love in my heart anyhow, even without knowing what te means. No, but actually te can actually be quite, to know these things can be quite helpful. And especially te is quite an easy word. It's because if you add an H and a Y, it's they. So, or here it means your, but te means they also. So it's almost like they, te. So similarly, other words here also, Yasmin, we must have heard that a few thousand times. What does Yasmin mean? What's that? Yeah. In which? Here it is translated in which. Nrinam, what does Nrinam mean?
The wealth of man.
Yeah, here it's human beings in the plural of the people. And Gramya? Yeah. Usually it's used in ordinary dealings, ordinary things. And Sukha?
Happiness.
So here is Su, what does Su mean? What's that? No, Su doesn't mean very. Ati means very lopsided. What's that? Su? Nice, yes. And ka? Space. So sukha means good space. So when people don't crowd you in, you feel happy. Similarly, when we don't feel crowded in the body, when it's not all tight and tense, then we feel happy. So sukha means happiness, good space. And dukkha means bad space. So if your space, you feel crowded in, either in the body or in the mind, or by other people, that's called dukkha, or unhappiness. So all you do is have to create some good space, and everything's all right, at least temporarily, until the space gets bad again. So let's go. Translation. Muni.
Muni.
Do we go? No. The sage.
The sage.
Vivakshu.
Vivakshu.
Describe. Bhagavat. Of the personality of Godhead. Gunanam.
Transcendental qualities.
Sakha. Friend. Api.
Also.
Te. Your. Bharatam. The
Mahabharata.
Aha. Has described. Krishna.
Krishna
Dwaitayana.
Yas.
Yasmin.
In which?
Nrinam.
Of the people.
Gramya. Worldly. Sukha anuvadai. Pleasure. Derived from mundane topics. Mati.
Attention.
Grihita,
new,
just to draw towards. Hare, of the Lord. Katayam, speeches of Bhagavad Gita. Grihita is actually a very popular word also, used a lot. It's found in words like graha, graha in astronomy and astrology. What's that? Yeah, graha. Actually, graha means to grab or to seize. So when you get attached to something, you more or less hold on to it and grab it. So that's graha, because the grahas, they grab hold of you. They twirl you around. So grihita is found a lot in Bhagavad Gita also. That kama Ashita Duspuram Dhanamana Madanvita Moha Grihi Vatan Vashad Patanti Narake Sucha. So being influenced by Kama Ashrita, taking shelter in satiable lust, and Kama Ashrita Duspuram, which is always burning. Duspuram Moha Kama Ashrita Duspuram Moha Dana Dhamma Dana Madanvitaha. Insatiable lust and absorbed in the conceit of false prestige. The demoniac are always sworn to unclean work attracted by the impermanent. So they're grihita, they grab hold of unclean work, just like they can't let go of it, they become really attached to it. Like trying to drag a little kid out of a mud hole or something. Come out, no, let me go. I'm happy in here. So this grihita, it's abominable, but people become, they grab onto it and they can't let it go. So they've grabbed onto intoxication, meat eating, illicit sex, gambling, and they think they're actually enjoying. And if someone tries to persuade them to let go of it, they think, oh, this is my greatest enemy, trying to take away the basic necessities of life from it. As I mentioned before, that when a prophet's, sometimes even prophet's early disciples, would complain the prophet is trying to take away the basic necessities of life. Illicit sex, intoxication, meeting, gambling. That prophet's denying love because he wants to take these things away. So that it's called grihita. And here are the words, here is explaining granya, sukha, anavida. So granya means worldly, and sukha means happiness, and anu means to follow, continue on. If someone's going in a certain direction, you just keep on going, it's called anu. Repeating again and again. Vidai means to talk about. So we hear some mundane thing, and we just can't wait till we meet the next person and we can reveal exactly what we heard. Thinking that, wow, that sounded great, and when I tell someone else about it, they'll think, wow, such a sage. So enlightened. So experienced. So this is called Gramyaga Anuvida. Gramyagata. And Matira means attention. Matirana Krishna Parataksato Vamito Vipadyeda Griha Vratana. So wherever we put our attention is called Mati, and generally people don't want to put their attention in Krishna. They think that that's a waste of time. But put their attention in mundane subjects, that's very important. Matirana Krishna Parataksato Va. They think, although everyone is suffering, they think that they can figure out their own solutions, or that others can help them figure out the solutions, or by their own efforts or a collection of others, they can figure out their solutions, but because they're absorbed in some limited conception of life, there's no solution. They think if I expand my space a little bit more, then I'll be happy, whether it's individually getting a bigger house. If my house gets bigger, then I'll have more space and I'll be able to relax. But in order to get the bigger house, I gotta work like a dog or something, even harder, for 20 more years. And so they just get a little bit more space. So during the time I'm cramped up in a little office, 8 hours a day, working to get some more space. And by the time I get more space, then I have a heart attack in the meantime. And I'm in the hospital for the next. So trying to get a little bit more space, some happiness, people wind up creating dukkha. They get less space. They're in a more precarious position. Because graha vrata, they've mistaken themselves to be a material body, and they can't conceive of anything beyond that. And beyond that they think, alright, beyond this body, I want to get out of this space, only thinking about myself, looking at my own belly button the whole day, trying to figure out how to keep it happy. So, let me expand my space, and therefore I get a house, I get a family, and then I try and keep them happy. And this way I think I'll become happy by being identify myself with a bigger space. And that doesn't make me satisfied, so then I expand my space beyond that to my community. I keep my grass clean and green, so everyone thinks that he's a nice person. And that way I become happy, that everyone's admiring what a nice person I am. I'm causing people when they see me to become happy by thinking, what a nice person. And then if that doesn't satisfy me, then the country, all humanity, and I can try and expand it, but because it's all based upon this false ego of identifying myself with the body, therefore I never really get it out of this bad space, this limited space of identifying with the body, and although I'm trying to expand it, I don't go really very far. I always remain within some very limited conception of existence. And why do people want to remain in the limited conception of existence? Because they think that the happiness coming from gratifying the senses is real happiness. They think that this is actually the only pleasure in life, and that all other so-called pleasures are just illusory, and that they're not really worthwhile to make any effort to achieve. They may be glorified and talked about, but they're talked about by primitive people who don't know how to eat with forks and knives. The proof that they're primitive is that we can see pictures they were eating with their hands. So how abominable eating with your hands? Because people never wash their hands. And then, you know, they think, my God, if I ever ate with my hands, what would I be eating? Who knows what's on the end of my hand? Even I don't know. So I think the proof that these people are primitive, they didn't even have enough intelligence how to manufacture a chair. They were sitting on the ground. And in spite of the fact that they were suffering because they didn't even have a chair and a table to eat with, they couldn't even figure out a knife and fork, and still they appear to be smiling. So they're in the lowest class of people. In spite of their suffering, they're so bewildered that they're even happy. They appear to be happy. They don't even know how much they're suffering. There's so much ignorance, people are thinking, that we're more simple. Therefore, how can we accept this philosophy as being true, that so-called, they have people with thousands of eyes riding around on elephants with thunderbolts in their hand. Yeah, right. And then other people have foreheads looking everywhere. Other people are riding around on swans and all kinds of things. You know. And we're supposed to believe that these people, you know, are happy. They're happy in their own little world, but it's not the real world. Therefore, people have lost because they have no confidence. They think, yes, the only thing is sense gratification. And if you don't get sense gratification, you just missed out on everything. Your life is completely wasted. And at the end of the life, you know, then you got actually nothing at all but some fantasy. And that's all you got for the whole life. So this is called Adanta Gaubhira Vishitanta Mizram. Although they believe like that, still they're creating not happiness for themselves, they're creating more misery. If having a nice atmosphere is a prerequisite, bodily, mentally, and physically for happiness, then just look where people are living. You know, every year the cities get more congested, they become more polluted, people are becoming more violent and frustrated. So if that's, they're creating happiness, then what is unhappiness? If that's happiness, imagine what unhappiness must be like. But the Vedic literature doesn't agree, so therefore we're studying this verse. Translation, your friend, the great sage, Krishna Dvaipayana Vyas, has already described the transcendental qualities of the Lord in his great work, the Mahabharata. But the whole idea is to draw attention of the mass of people to Krishna Katha, Bhagavad Gita, through their strong affinity to hearing mundane topics. So Vyasadeva was not some kind of ethereal philosopher just floating around in the Himalayas. He was actually a very practical, down-to-earth person. He knew what he was doing. It wasn't that he was, you know, up in the Himalayas and he was a sage. What does he know about life? Therefore, he came up with all these fantastic stories. Maybe one day someone can make it into the movie and there'll be some value to it. But in the meantime, he's written some fantastic stories that really are not applicable to anyone. And even we ourselves may be doubting sometimes, what is this all about? The Sanskrit, these word for words, this translation, something about some vana and ashram system, gurukul, you know, submission, all kinds of things. You know, this is, you know, I mean, this is not modern at all. This is primitive. Talking about Krishna, fixing the mind upon Krishna. You know, I mean, maybe Krishna was just a, you know, a primitive cowherd boy, an aborigine cowherd boy in this primitive village called Vrindavan. And later on, because they had no one else, after they got tired of talking about Indra and Agni and Kubera, they decided to, you know, let's change it for a while. Let's worship this primitive aborigine cowherd boy in Vrindavan. See what that's like. So here's the purport. The great sage Krishna Dvaipayana Vyasa is the author of all Vedic literature, of which his works Vedanta Sutra, Srimad Bhagavatam, and Mahabharata are very popular readings. As stated in the Bhagavatam 1.4.25, Srila Vyasadeva compiled the Mahabharata for the less intelligent class of men who take more interest in mundane topics than in the philosophy of life. So that's what Mahabharata is. It's meant actually for people who are interested in mundane subject matters. We're not that all mundane subject matters are bad, because for us, some of the mundane subject matters may seem practically transcendental, because they deal with morality. Mahabharata is particularly dealing with morality. It's on, practically is on the same level as the Bible is. Don't kill, don't have illicit sex, don't commit adultery, don't do all of these things. This is more or less what Mahabharata is. But Mahabharata is a little bit more sophisticated, because it talks about the different ages and what happens when you perform these sinful activities. You insult some sage, the next moment some elephant runs you over. You get like karma. It's talking about mostly about karma and what the reactions are to karma, good and bad. So people like reading about it. Seems quite interesting. They talk about all these, especially wars, romance, all the topics that people are generally interested in, but in a way that's even more appealing in some senses. You know, it's not just ordinary society girls, it's apsaras they're talking about. It's not talking about some ordinary war, it's wars with, you know, weapons of fire, weapons of air, weapons of ether, weapons of water, weapons of earth. You know, people, you know, two yojanas high fighting as other people, eagles coming over, birds coming over and picking up tortoises the size of mountains and eating them. You know, interesting stories. But the Vedanta Sutra was compiled for persons already above the mundane topics, who might have already tasted the bitterness of the so-called happiness of mundane affairs. In other words, even if you're an eagle and you're able to pick up an elephant the size of a mountain or a tortoise the size of a mountain and take it over to your famous tree, which is 100 yojanas high, and sit there and eat the eagle and the tortoise, still actually they don't really taste that good. Still there's, after all, there's better things to do, in other words. That the sense gratification in the material world, even up to the heavenly planets, is not the highest perfection of life. So those who can realize that, although there may be some material happiness, there's also material distress, and therefore they're interested in some other topic, therefore Śrīla Vyāsadeva wrote the Vedanta Sutra to give some other perspective on reality. So the first aphorism of Vedanta Sutra is Atato Brahma Jignāsya. Only when one has finished the business of mundane inquiries in the marketplace of sense gratification can one make relevant inquiries regarding Brahman, the transcendence. In other words, when we're actually convinced that material happiness won't really make us happy, then we'll actually make relevant inquiries. In some temples around here, we find if you go there, there's so many inquiries, but 90% of them are not very relevant to the process of advancing in devotional service. Most of them are more or less challenging, trying to figure out how these books are actually speculations. So the books, then we can conclude, since the books are just speculations, and I'm speculating, so these books don't know what's going on, I don't know what's going on, so we're more or less on the same level. So I can do what I want, and the books can tell me what they want me to do, but then still, because we're all on the same level, I can do whatever I want. But when one is actually convinced that I'm not going to become happy by any kind of material endeavor, then real relevant inquiries awaken within the mind how I can actually make tangible advancement towards transcendence. If I have one hand clutching on to the material, my material desires, my material attachments, and I'm crying out with the other hand, you know, please Krishna, save me. And Krishna says, well, take your hand off your material attachment, then I can save you. Just like Draupadi, when she was clutching her sari, but she was with one hand crying out for Krishna, then Krishna couldn't do very much. Because if Krishna came, he would have interfered with her independence of clutching. He would have had to yank her hand off. He would have been just like Dusasana was trying to take her clothes off, and Krishna would be yanking her hand, people yanking at the same time. Maybe Draupadi would have split apart or something. No, when Draupadi gave up, or holding on herself, then Krishna was actually able to do something. Similarly, if Krishna enlightened us, then we get this, you know, then we think, oh my God, I've just been enlightened. I just lost all my material attachments. But I didn't want to lose my material attachments. I just lost the best part of my life because I got enlightened. So Krishna, unless we actually are desirous of getting free from material attachments, there's not very much Krishna can do. So the Vedanta Sutra is meant for those who are actually above the platform of mundane inquiry. And that's not so easy, because most of us are considering, you know, thinking once in a while, what's for prasad? I hope it's something good. You know, I can't work too hard because, you know, I'll get tired. So we're into, to a certain extent, we have some material attachments. And so Vedanta Sutra, which is dealing with transcendence, may not be so appealing. Those persons who are busy with mundane inquiries, which fill the newspapers and other such literatures, are classified as Sri Sudra Dvita Bandhus, or women, the laborer class, and the unworthy sons of the higher classes, Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, and Vaishyas. Such less intelligent men cannot understand the purpose of Vedanta Sutra, though they may make a show of studying the sutras in a perverted way. The real purpose of Vedanta Sutra is explained by the author himself in the Srimad Bhagavatam, and anyone trying to understand Vedanta Sutra without reference to Srimad Bhagavatam is certainly misguided. Such misguided persons who are interested in the mundane affairs of philanthropic and altruistic work under the misconception the body is the self could better take advantage of the Mahabharata, which is specifically compiled by Srila Vyasadeva for their benefit. The great author has compiled the Mahabharata in such a way that the less intelligent class of men, who are more interested in mundane topics, may read the Mahabharata with great relish, and in the course of such mundane happiness can take advantage of Bhagavad Gita, the preliminary study of Srimad Bhagavatam or the Vedanta Sutra. In other words, the whole idea of Mahabharata is, as Krishna says, or is in the beginning of the Srimad Bhagavatam, Dharma prayojita kaitavotra paramoni matsarana satam vedyam vastavam atra vasu shivadam tapatra la mulanam shrimad bhagavatam mahamuni kritam kimvapara ishraha sadyovi rudite kritivi shushutivir takshuna. That this Srimad Bhagavatam that we're reading now, it rejects all these attempts at trying to be happy in the material world as more or less as cheating, because they don't really make us happy. But the Mahabharata was written for people who like to hear about these topics. But what they'll hear about is that you can't be happy in the material world, that you have to regulate. If you want to be as happy as possible in the material world, then you have to regulate your activities. That's what's being stressed. You have to find out what is your duty. And you have to do that. If you don't do your duty in relation to everyone, then you'll be in trouble. So that may be duties in relationship to your society, in relation to your family, in relationship to your ancestors, that one has so many different duties, and if one wants to be as happy as possible in the material world, you have to follow your duty. And if one doesn't follow one's duty, then there'll be so many problems. Even if one is Indra in the heavenly planets, if Indra violates his obligations, he doesn't perform his duty, then he winds up in a lotus flower for some thousands of years, hiding from the demons. That no one's immune from their occupational duty. And everyone has a duty, and one should find out what that duty is, and then one will follow it, or otherwise it'll certainly be difficult. But even if one perfectly performs his duty, still one winds up dissatisfied. Therefore, Bhagavad Gita is there to explain the essence of the Mahabharata, why when everyone is dissatisfied, even if one performs his duty, because the essential ingredient, the whole purpose is Krishna consciousness. Unless one comes to Krishna consciousness, one can't be satisfied. Nasti buddhya yuktasya, nacha yuktasya bhavanaha, nacha bhavintak shantir, ashantasya kutak sukha. That for one who's not in transcendental or Krishna consciousness, one cannot have a controlled mind, nor steady intelligence, without which there can be no possibility of peace, and how can there be happiness without peace? That if every moment my conception of life is changing, one moment I'm a spirit soul, next moment I'm a body, then I'm the mind, then who knows what I am, I'm a different identity. If my mind can be controlled, one time I like someone or something, next moment I hate that thing or that person, if my mind is simply changing all the time and I'm attached to my mind, then and my perception of life is constantly changing, I have no idea what to do to control my mind, or even if I should control my mind, or if I should just try to enjoy my mind, if my whole conception of life is constantly flickering from one thing to the next, then I can't be peaceful. And if one is not peaceful, where is there any question of happiness? So if our goal is happiness, then it's certainly not by agitating the mind or by some absurd conception of life or misconception of life. Therefore, Bhagavad Gita is given so that one can understand what the truth is, that one has to come to transcendence, either Brahman or Paramatma or Bhagavan. Somehow or another, one has to get beyond material unsteady conception of life. But the Mahabharata just deals with the whole conception of sorrows, great kings, great personalities. But ultimately, we find that most of them, when they're enlightened, they go into the forest. After living a life of great opulence, what is the wisdom they get? They wind up going to the forest and living in the forest and trying to fix their minds upon Krishna by going through great austerity. Therefore, we shouldn't be unhappy that we're not great kings and princes. Of course, modern society has given everyone that facility to live as a great king or prince. We may not have so many servants, but we have our washing machine, obedient, who always obeys our orders, unless it breaks down and we have to help out our poor servant. We have our dishwashers, we have our car, we have so many things, and they're all our servants. And this way I'm living like a great king. I don't do anything, I just drop a few grapes in my mouth once in a while, and my automatic massager massages my foot while the automatic grape dropper drops grapes in my mouth. And I do that for half an hour a day, and then go out and work like a dog for 12 hours to pay off the machines. But at least for that half an hour a day, I'm in bliss, thinking I'm actually the Lord. That even Nero, he couldn't even enjoy life as much as I am for that half an hour a day. Śrīla Vyāsadeva, no interest in writing a history of mundane activities, other than to give the less intelligent persons a chance for transcendental realization through Bhagavad Gita. Yudhora's reference to the Mahabharata indicates that he had heard the Mahabharata from Vyāsadeva, his real father, while he was away from home and was touring the place as a pilgrimage. So here we find out more or less the whole purpose of this verse is to tell us that Mahabharata, if you want to understand Mahabharata, you don't have to buy the big edition, all you do is have to read Bhagavad Gita. Everything is there. And if one gets caught up reading all these different stories in Mahabharata and forgets Krishna, then one has wasted his time. Or at least one has come to the same level as Sri, Shudra, Dvija Bandhuna. But that's not what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to rise above that level to the platform of devotional service. But there are certainly a class of people who are on that level, who, when they read Mahabharata, may become a little convinced that actually Krishna and these other personalities were great personalities, and therefore may take a little interest in reading Bhagavad Gita. We find that sometimes when people have seen the play, the Mahabharata, or watched it on television, there's a little bit of an interest to read Bhagavad Gita, and therefore the play was successful. Nothing in the play probably had any benefit for people. The only benefit was that they decided to read Bhagavad Gita. Therefore, if we ourselves read Bhagavad Gita or hear Bhagavad Gita, then we've come to the conclusion of the Mahabharata. Our interest in Mahabharata has been perfected. And if we read these literatures without becoming enthusiastic to hear Bhagavad Gita, then we've just wasted our time. First, the Bhagavad Gita. So, any questions? Thank you. Yes.
Maharaj, you were speaking at the beginning about the humble soldier that doesn't want to be learned or to learn something. So we are said we should be more humble than the lady breast, and then I get the feeling that people should be a lady of grass, so I should just stand on there and people can step over something.
If people step on you now, you'll scream. And if you don't scream now, you'll scream later.
The question is, what is humility and how it should be practiced?
Humility means that I understand I'm Krishna's servant and I follow what Krishna wants me to do. I see things as Krishna wants me to see them because that's reality. Not that I'm just... Because Krishna sees things as they actually are, therefore I try to see Krishna. Things as Krishna sees them. So Krishna says that I'm a very tiny soul, and that ultimately I'm everyone's servant, and that Krishna is unlimited and unlimitedly great and wonderful. So I try to see that. So when I see how wonderful Krishna is, then naturally I'll feel a little humble. If I just try artificially to be humble in relationship to everyone else, who I think is just as insignificant as I am, or less significant than I am, then that'll be very difficult. And I see how, in relationship to Krishna, everyone is so insignificant, especially me, then obviously I'll become humble when I see how great Krishna is. I mean, if you meet someone who can create, who's the president of Belgium, the prime minister of Belgium, then you feel a little bit in awe. He is a very important person. Or if you meet the president of the United States, then you're a little in awe. But what to speak of if you meet a person who's created billions of presidents by just a little fraction of his energy? Then not how much aura we'll feel then. So naturally we'll feel quite great humility. So that in relation to Krishna, that we have to feel humble. If we feel humble in relationship to the material energy, that will be a little artificial. It may not last very long. And on that basis, when we can see how great Krishna is, then I can tolerate, because I understand that Krishna is, how things I'm experiencing, why things arrange for me. Therefore, I can learn tolerance. And learn how to see how Krishna is working through everyone. Therefore, I can give everyone respect, knowing that whatever I can do is by Krishna's grace, and by the grace of Krishna's associates, his representative. Therefore, I won't try and take credit for myself. I'll see everything in relation to Krishna. I'll appreciate everyone and everything as it's related to Krishna. And knowing that whatever I can do is also being done by Krishna, I won't take credit myself for it. And this way we have to understand the philosophy in relation to Krishna. Anything else? Yes.
So, after hearing Mahabharata for 6 months, and after hearing that actually Bhagavad Gita suggests we go and continue another 6 months to read Mahabharata without reading any other books, and how is it?
I don't know. I haven't done it. How is it? Have you done that?
No.
The Mahabharatas we get, that most of the devotees put out are really condensed versions of it. The actual Mahabharata is, they have the Ganguly edition, 20 volumes, of like 300 pages of small little tight print. And it's full of stories within a story within a story, all about, it all centers around the laws of karma. If you don't follow the law of karma, what happens? If you perform the right sacrifice, what happens? So you can hear a book which is actually tens of thousands of pages of morality stories. So at the end of hearing all those morality stories, the idea is that you should finally realize I should follow the laws of karma. I should do my duty, what I'm supposed to do. And I shouldn't do what I'm not supposed to do. So after reading Mahabharata, if one comes to that conclusion, that's nice. But if you read these short little versions they have out now, well, it's just like some interesting story, but that's about what it is. Keeps everyone entertained if you tell the story, but it doesn't really bring out the essence of how the laws of karma work so well. It's more like a drama or something. You know, Karna being great protagonist, and, you know, how everyone cries at the end when he's killed. But, you know, it doesn't really teach you anything. That's very much, actually. Yes? Yeah, but everything is related to Krishna. So whatever you say is Krishna Katha. Mahabharata, when it talks about some sage meeting some apsara and falling in love with her, is that related, how is that related to Krishna? But that's very small in the actual whole Mahabharata. Krishna is hardly mentioned in the Mahabharata. And even when he's usually a minor character. He's not very emphasized very much. Only like in Bhagavad Gita does he really get to say what he really thinks. Otherwise, there's not much about Krishna in the Mahabharata. But, you know, we'd like to read some.